Satan. At that period of his life, I lost sight of my young comrade. Did he go to war? I think he entered the service. In what force? In the Navy. Are you not his confessor?
No, sir.
I believe he is a Lutheran.
A Lutheran?
I say I believe such is the case. I do not affirm it. Besides, liberty of conscience is established in France.
Doubtless. And we are not now inquiring into his creed, but his actions. In the name of the Prefect of Police, I demand, what do you know of him?
He passes for a very charitable man. Our Holy Father, the Pope, has made him a Knight of Jesus Christ for the services he rendered to the Christians in the East. He has 5 or 6 rings as testimonials from Eastern monarchs of his services.
Does he wear them?
No, but he is proud of them. He is better pleased with rewards given to the benefactors of man than to his destroyers.
He is a Quaker, then?
Exactly. He is a Quaker, with the exception of the peculiar dress.
Has he any friends?
Yes. Everyone who knows him is his friend.
But has he any enemies?
One only.
What is his name?
Lord Wilmore.
Where is he?
He is in Paris just now.
Can he give me any particulars?
Important ones. He was in India with Zacconi.
Do you know his abode?
It is somewhere in La Chaussée d'Antin, but I know neither the street nor the number.
Are you at variance with the Englishman?
I love Zacconi, and he hates him. We are consequently not friends.
Do you think the Count of Monte Cristo had ever been in France before he made this visit to Paris?
To that question, I can answer positively.
No, sir.
He had never been, because he applied to me 6 months since for the particulars he required, and as I knew not when I might again come to Paris, I recommended Monsieur Cavalcanti to him.
Andrea?
No, Bartolomeo, his father.
Now, sir, I have but one more question to ask, and I charge you in the name of honor, of humanity, and of religion to answer me candidly.
What is it, sir?
Do you know with what design Monsieur de Monte Cristo purchased a house at Auteuil?
Certainly, for he told me.
What was it, sir?
To make a lunatic asylum of it, similar to that founded by the Count of Pisani at Palermo. Do you know that edifice?
I have heard of it.
It is a magnificent institution. Having said this, the abbé bowed to imply he wished to pursue his studies. The visitor either understood the abbé's meaning or had no more questions to ask. He rose, and the abbé accompanied him to the door.
"You are a great almsgiver," said the visitor, "and although you are said to be rich, I will venture to offer you something for your poor people. Will you accept my offering?"
"I thank you, sir. I am only jealous of one thing, namely, that the relief I give should be entirely from my own resources.
However,
my resolution, sir, is unchangeable. However, you have only to search for yourself, and you will find, alas, but too many objects upon whom to exercise your benevolence." The abbé once more bowed as he opened the door. The stranger bowed and took his leave, and the carriage conducted him straight to the house of Monsieur de Villefort. An hour afterwards, the carriage was again ordered, and this time it went to the Rue Fontaine Saint-Georges and stopped at No. 5, where Lord Wilmore lived. The stranger had written to Lord Wilmore requesting an interview, which the latter had fixed for 10 o'clock. As the envoy of the Prefect of Police arrived 10 minutes before 10, he was told that Lord Wilmore, who was precision and punctuality personified, was not yet come in, but that he would be sure to return as the clock struck. The visitor was introduced into the drawing room, which was like all other furnished drawing rooms.
a mantelpiece with two modern Sèvres vases, a timepiece representing Cupid with his bent bow, a looking glass with an engraving on each side, one representing Homer carrying his guide, the other Belisarius begging, a greyish paper, red and black tapestry, such was the appearance of Lord Wilmore's drawing-room. It was illuminated by lamps with ground-glass shades which gave only a feeble light, as if out of consideration for the envoy's weak sight. After 10 minutes' expectation, the clock struck 10. At the 5th stroke, the door opened, and Lord Wilmore appeared. He was rather above the middle height, with thin, reddish whiskers, light complexion and light hair turning rather grey. He was dressed with all the English peculiarity, namely, in a blue coat with gilt buttons and high collar in the fashion of 1811, a white kerseymere waistcoat and nankeen pantaloons, 3 inches too short, but which were prevented by straps from slipping up to the knee. His first remark on entering was, "You know, sir, I do not speak French." "I know you do not like to converse in our language," replied the envoy. "But you may use it," replied Lord Wilmore. "I understand it." "And I," replied the visitor, changing his idiom, "know enough of English to keep up the conversation. Do not put yourself to the slightest inconvenience."
"Hey-ho," said Lord Wilmore, with that tone which is only known to natives of Great Britain.
The envoy presented his letter of introduction, which the latter read with English coolness, and having finished,
"I understand," said he, "perfectly."
Then began the questions, which were similar to those which had been addressed to the Abbé Busoni. But as Lord Wilmore, in the character of the Count's enemy, was less restrained in his answers, they were more numerous. He described the youth of Monte Cristo, who, he said, at 10 years of age, entered the service of one of those petty sovereigns of India who make war on the English. It was there Wilmore had first met him and fought against him. In that war, Zaccone had been taken prisoner, sent to England, put on the pontoon, whence he had escaped by swimming. Then began his travels, his duels, his passions. Then came the insurrection in Greece, and he had served in the Grecian ranks. While in that service, he had discovered a silver mine in the mountains of Thessaly, but he had been careful to conceal it from everyone. After the Battle of Navarino, when the Greek government was consolidated, he asked of King Otto a mining grant for that district which was given him. Hence that immense fortune which might, in Lord Wilmore's opinion, amount to 1 or 2 millions per annum, a precarious fortune which might be momentarily lost by the failure of the mine. "But," asked the visitor, "do you know why he came to France?"
"He is speculating in railways," said Lord Wilmore, "and being a clever theorist, he has discovered a new telegraph, which he is seeking to bring to perfection." "How much does he spend yearly?" asked the prefect. "Not more than 500 or 600 francs, said Lord Wilmore. "He is a miser."
Hatred evidently inspired the Englishman, who, knowing no other reproach to bring on the Count, accused him of avarice.
"Do you know his house at Auteuil?"
"Certainly."
"What do you know respecting it?"
"Do you wish to know why he bought it?"
"Yes."
"The Count is a speculator who will certainly ruin himself in experiments. He supposes there is in the neighbourhood of the house he has bought a mineral spring equal to those of Baguère, Luchon, and Courtrai. He is going to turn his house into a bathhouse, as the Germans term it. He has already dug up all the garden 2 or 3 times to find the famous spring, and being unsuccessful, he will soon purchase all the contiguous houses. Now, as I dislike him, and hope his railway, his electric telegraph, or his search for baths will ruin him, I am watching for his discomfiture, which must soon take place."
"What was the cause of your quarrel?"
when in England he seduced the wife of one of my friends.
Why do you not seek revenge?
I have already fought 3 duels with him, said the Englishman, the first with the pistol, the second with the sword, and the third with the 2-handed sword.
And what was the result of those duels?
The first time he broke my arm, the second he wounded me in the breast, and the third time made this large wound.
The Englishman turned down his shirt collar and showed a scar whose redness proved it to be a recent one.
So that, you see, there is a deadly feud between us.
This was all the visitor wished to ascertain, or rather all the Englishman appeared to know. The agent rose, and having bowed to Lord Wilmore, who returned his salutation with the stiff politeness of the English, he retired. Lord Wilmore, having heard the door close after him, returned to his bedroom, where with one hand he pulled off his light hair, his red whiskers, his false jaw, and his wound, to resume his own black hair, the dark complexion, and the pearly teeth of the Count of Monte Cristo. It was Monsieur de Villefort, and not the prefect, who returned to the house of Monsieur de Villefort. The Procureur du Roi felt more at ease, although he had learned nothing really satisfactory, and, for the first time since the dinner party at Auteuil, he slept soundly. 71. The Ball. It was in the warmest days of July when, in due course of time, the Saturday arrived upon which the ball of Monsieur de Morcerf was to take place. It was 10 o'clock at night. The large trees in the garden of the Count's hotel threw up their branches towards the azure canopy of heaven studded with golden stars, but where the last mists of a storm which had threatened all day yet glided. From the apartments on the ground floor might be heard the sound of music, with the whirl of the waltz and galop, while brilliant streams of light shone through the openings of the Venetian blinds. At this moment the garden was only occupied by about 10 servants, who had just received orders from their mistress to prepare the supper, the serenity of the weather continuing to increase. Until now it had been undecided whether the supper should take place in the dining room or under a long tent erected on the lawn, but the beautiful blue sky covered with stars had determined the case in favour of the lawn. The gardens were illuminated with coloured lanterns, according to the Italian custom, and, as usual in those countries where the luxuries of the table are well understood, the supper table was loaded with wax lights and flowers. At the time the Countess de Morcerf returned to the rooms after giving her orders, many guests were arriving, more attracted by the charming hospitality of the Countess than by the distinguished position of the Count, for, owing to the good taste of Mercedes, one was sure of finding some arrangements at her fête worthy of relating, or even copying, in case of need. Madame Danglars, in whom the events we have related had caused deep anxiety, had hesitated in going to Madame de Morcerf when, during the morning, her carriage happened to cross that of de Villefort. The latter made a sign, and the carriages having drawn close together, he said, "You are going to Madame de Morcerf's, are you not?"
"No," replied Madame Danglars, "I am too ill."
"You are wrong," replied Villefort significantly. "It is important that you should be seen there."
"In that case, I will go."
And the 2 carriages passed on towards their different destinations. Madame Danglars, therefore, came not only beautiful in person, but radiant with splendour. She entered by one door at the same time that Mercedes appeared at the other. The Countess took Albert to meet Madame Danglars. He approached, paid her some well-merited compliments on her toilet, and offered his arm to conduct her to a seat. Albert looked around him.
"You are looking for my daughter?" said the Baroness, smiling.
"I confess it," replied Albert. "Could you have been so cruel as not to bring her?"
"Calm yourself. She has met Mademoiselle de Villefort, and has taken her arm. See, they are following us, both in white dresses, one with a bouquet of camellias, the other with one of myosotis. But tell me, Well, what do you wish to know? Will not the Count of Monte Cristo be here tonight?
17, replied Albert.
What do you mean?
I only mean that the Count seems the rage, replied the Viscount, smiling, and that you are the 17th person that has asked me the same question. The Count is in fashion. I congratulate him upon it.
And have you replied to everyone as you have to me?
Ah, to be sure, I have not answered you.
Be satisfied, we shall have this lion. We are among the privileged ones.
Were you at the opera yesterday?
No.
He was there?
Ah, indeed. And did the eccentric person commit any new originality?
Can he be seen without doing so?
Elsler was dancing in Le Diable Boiteux. The Greek princess was in ecstasies. After the cachucha, he placed a magnificent ring on the stem of a bouquet and threw it to the charming danseurs, who, in the third act, to do honor to the gift, reappeared with it on her finger.
And the Greek princess, will she be here?
No, you will be deprived of that pleasure. Her position in the Count's establishment is not sufficiently understood.
Wait, leave me here and go and speak to Madame de Villefort, who is longing to engage your attention.
Albert bowed to Madame Danglars and advanced towards Madame de Villefort, whose lips opened as he approached. I wager anything, said Albert, interrupting her, that I know what you were about to say.
Well, what is it?
You were going to ask me if the Count of Monte Cristo were arrived or expected.
Not at all. It is not of him that I am now thinking. I was going to ask you if you had received any news of Monsieur France.
Yes, yesterday.
What did he tell you?
That he was leaving at the same time as his letter.
Well, now then, the Count.
The Count will come. Be satisfied.
You know that he has another name besides Monte Cristo?
No, I did not know it.
Monte Cristo is the name of an island, and he has a family name.
I never heard it.
Well then, I am better informed than you. His name is Zaccone.
It is possible.
He is a Maltese.
That is also possible.
The son of a ship owner.
Really, you should relate all this aloud. You would have the greatest success.
He served in India, discovered a mine in Thessaly, and comes to Paris to form an establishment of mineral waters at Auteuil.
Well, I'm sure, said Morcerf, this is indeed news. Am I allowed to repeat it?
Yes, but cautiously. Tell one thing at a time, and do not say, I told you.
Why so?
Because it is a secret just discovered.
By whom?
The police.
Then the news originated at the prefect's last night.
Paris, you can understand, is astonished at the sight of such unusual splendor, and the police have made inquiries.
Good. Nothing more is wanting than to arrest the Count as a vagabond on the pretext of his being too rich.
Indeed, this would doubtless have happened if his credentials had not been so favorable.
Poor Count. And is he aware of the danger he has been in?
I think not.
Then it will be but charitable to inform him. When he arrives, I will not fail to do so. Just then, a handsome young man with bright eyes, black hair, and glossy moustache respectfully bowed to Madame de Villefort. Albert extended him his hand. Madame, said Albert, allow me to present to you Monsieur Maximilien Morel, captain of Spahi, one of our best and, above all, of our bravest officers.
I have already had the pleasure of meeting this gentleman at Auteuil, at the house of the Count of Monte Cristo, replied Madame de Villefort, turning away with marked coldness of manner.
This answer, and above all, the tone in which it was uttered, chilled the heart of poor Morel. But a recompense was in store for him.
Turning round, he saw near the door a beautiful fair face, whose large blue eyes were, without any marked expression, fixed upon him, while the bouquet of myosotis was gently raised to the lips. The salutation was so well understood that Morel, with the same expression in his eyes, placed his handkerchief to his mouth. And these two living statues, whose hearts beat so violently under their marble aspect, separated from each other by the whole length of the room, forgot themselves for a moment, or rather forgot the world in their mutual contemplation. They might have remained much longer, lost in one another, without anyone noticing their abstraction. The Count of Monte Cristo had just entered. He advanced through the crowd of curious glances and exchange of salutations towards Madame de Morcerf, who, standing before a mantelpiece ornamented with flowers, had seen his entrance in a looking-glass placed opposite the door and was prepared to receive him. She turned towards him with a serene smile just at the moment he was bowing to her. No doubt she fancied the Count would speak to her, while on his side the Count thought she was about to address him. But both remained silent, and after a mere bow, Monte Cristo directed his steps to Albert, who received him cordially.
"Have you seen my mother?" asked Albert.
"I have just had the pleasure," replied the Count. "But I have not seen your father. See, he is down there, talking politics with that little group of great geniuses." Just then the Count felt his arm pressed. He turned round. It was Danglars.
"Ah, is it you, Baron?" said he. "Why do you call me Baron?" said Danglars. "You know that I care nothing for my title. I am not like you, Viscount. You like your title, do you not?"
"Certainly," replied Albert, "seeing that without my title I should be nothing, while you, sacrificing the Baron, would still remain the millionaire,
which seems to me the finest title under the royalty of July," replied Danglars.
"Unfortunately," said Monte Cristo, "one's title to a millionaire does not last for life, like that of Baron, Peer of France, or Academician. For example, the millionaires Frank and Pullman of Frankfurt, who have just become bankrupts."
"Indeed," said Danglars, becoming pale.
"Yes, I received the news this evening by a courier. I had about a million in their hands, but, warned in time, I withdrew it a month ago."
"Ah," exclaimed Danglars, "they have drawn on me for 200,000 francs.
"Well, you can guard against it. Their signature is worth 5%.
"Yes, but it is too late," said Danglars. "I have honored their bills."
"Good," said Monte Cristo. "Here are 200,000 francs gone after—"
"Hush! Do not mention these things," said Danglars.
Then, approaching Monte Cristo, he added,
"Especially before young Monsieur Cavalcanti."
After which he smiled and turned towards the young man in question. Albert had left the Count to speak to his mother, Danglars to converse with young Cavalcanti. Monte Cristo was for an instant alone. Meanwhile, the heat became excessive. The footmen were hastening through the rooms with waiters loaded with ices. Monte Cristo wiped the perspiration from his forehead, but drew back when the waiter was presented to him. He took no refreshment. Madame de Morcerf did not lose sight of Monte Cristo. She saw that he took nothing, and even noticed the movement with which he withdrew from it.
"Albert," she asked, "did you notice that?"
"What, mother?"
"That the Count will never accept an invitation to dine with us."
"Yes, but then he breakfasted with me. Indeed, he made his first appearance in the world on that occasion."
"But your house is not Monsieur de Morcerf's," murmured Mercedes, "and since he has been here, I have watched him."
"Well?"
"Well, he has taken nothing yet."
"The Count is very temperate." Mercedes smiled sadly.
"Approach him," said she, "and the next waiter that passes, insist upon his taking something."
"But why, mother?"
"Oblige me, Albert," said Mercedes.
Albert kissed his mother's hand and drew near to the Count. Another salver passed, loaded as the preceding ones.
She saw Albert attempt to persuade the Count, but he obstinately refused. Albert rejoined his mother. She was very pale.
"Well," said she, "you see, he refuses."
"Yes, but why need this annoy you?"
"You know, Albert, women are singular creatures. I should like to have seen the Count take something in my house, if only a morsel of pomegranate. Perhaps he cannot reconcile himself to the French style of living, and might prefer something else. Oh, no, I have seen him eat of everything in Italy. No doubt he does not feel inclined this evening."
"And besides," said the Countess, "accustomed as he is to burning climates, possibly he does not feel the heat as we do."
"I do not think that, for he has complained of feeling almost suffocated, and asked why the Venetian blinds were not opened as well as the windows."
"In a word," said Mercedes, "it was a way of assuring me that his abstinence was intended."
And she left the room.
A minute afterwards the blinds were thrown open, and through the jessamine and clematis that overhung the window might be seen the garden ornamented with lanterns, and the supper laid under the tent. Dancers, players, talkers, all uttered an exclamation of joy. Everyone inhaled with delight the breeze that floated in. At the same time Mercedes reappeared, paler than before, but with an immovable expression of countenance which she sometimes wore. She went straight to the group of which her husband formed the center.
"Do not detain these gentlemen here, Count," she said. "They would prefer, I should think, to breathe in the garden rather than suffocate here, since they are not playing."
"Ah," said a gallant old general, who in 1809 had sung Partons pour la Syrie, "we will not go alone to the garden."
"Then," said Mercedes, "I will lead the way."
Turning towards Monte Cristo, she added, "Count, will you oblige me with your arm?"
The Count almost staggered at these simple words. Then he fixed his eyes on Mercedes. It was but the glance of a moment, but it seemed to the Countess to have lasted for a century, so much was expressed in that one look. He offered his arm to the Countess. She leaned upon it, or rather, just touched it with her little hand, and they, together, descended the steps lined with rhododendrons and camellias. Behind them, by another outlet, a group of about 20 persons rushed into the garden with loud exclamations of delight.
72. Bread and Salt. Madame de Morcerf entered an archway of trees with her companion. It was a grove of lindens conducting to a conservatory.
"It was too warm in the room, was it not, Count?" she asked.
"Yes, madame, and it was an excellent idea of yours to open the doors and the blinds."
As he ceased speaking, the Count felt the hand of Mercedes tremble. "But you," he said, "with that light dress and without anything to cover you but that gauze scarf, perhaps you feel cold?"
"Do you know where I am leading you?" said the Countess, without replying to the question of Monte Cristo.
"No, madame," replied Monte Cristo, "but you see I make no resistance."
"We are going to the greenhouse that you see at the end of this grove."
The Count looked at Mercedes as if to interrogate her, but she continued walking in silence. On his side, Monte Cristo also said nothing. They reached the building, ornamented with magnificent fruits, which ripen even in July in the artificial temperature which takes the place of the sun so frequently absent in our climate. The Countess left the arm of Monte Cristo and gathered a bunch of muscatel grapes.
"See, Count," she said, with a smile so sad in its expression that one could almost see the tears on her eyelids.
"See, our French grapes are not to be compared, I know, with yours of Sicily and Cyprus, but you will make allowance for our northern sun."
The Count bowed and stepped back.
"Do you refuse?" said Mercedes in a tremulous voice.
"Pray excuse me, madame," replied Monte Cristo, "but I never eat muscatel grapes."
Mercedes let them fall and sighed.
A magnificent peach was hanging against an adjoining wall, ripened by the same artificial heat. Mercedes drew near and plucked the fruit. "Take this peach, then," she said. The Count again refused.
"What? Again?"
she exclaimed in so plaintive an accent that it seemed but to stifle a sob.
"Really, you pain me."
A long silence succeeded this scene. The peach, like the grapes, was rolling on the ground.
"Count," added Mercedes with a supplicating glance, "there is a beautiful Arabian custom which makes eternal friends of those who have together eaten bread and salt beneath the same roof."
"I know it, madame," replied the Count. "But we are in France and not in Arabia, and in France eternal friendships are as rare as the custom of dividing bread and salt with one another."
"But," said the Countess breathlessly, with her eyes fixed on Monte Cristo, whose arm she convulsively pressed with both hands, "we are friends, are we not?"
The Count became pale as death. The blood rushed to his heart, and then again rising, dyed his cheeks with crimson. His eyes swam like those of a man suddenly dazzled.
"Certainly, we are friends," he replied. "Why should we not be such?"
The answer was so little like the one Mercedes desired that she turned away to give vent to a sigh, which sounded more like a groan.
"Thank you," she said,
and they recommenced walking. They went the whole length of the garden without uttering a word.
"Sir,"
suddenly exclaimed the Countess, after their walk had continued 10 minutes in silence,
"is it true that you have seen so much, travelled so far, and suffered so deeply?"
"I have suffered deeply, madame," answered Monte Cristo.
"But now you are happy?"
"Doubtless," replied the Count, "since no one hears me complain."
"And your present happiness, has it softened your heart?"
"My present happiness equals my past misery," said the Count.
"Are you not married?" asked the Countess.
"I? Married?" exclaimed Monte Cristo, shuddering. "Who could have told you so? No one told me you were. But you have frequently been seen at the opera with a young and lovely person." "She is a slave, whom I bought at Constantinople, madame, the daughter of a prince. I have adopted her as my daughter, having no one else to love in the world."
"You live alone, then?"
"I do."
"You have no sister, no son, no father?"
"I have no one."
"How can you exist thus, without anyone to attach you to life?"
"It is not my fault, madame. At Malta, I loved a young girl, was on the point of marrying her, when war came and carried me away. I thought she loved me well enough to wait for me, and even to remain faithful to my grave. When I returned, she was married. This is the history of most men who have passed 20 years of age. Perhaps my heart was weaker than those of the generality, and I suffered more than they would have done in my place." "You know all." The Countess stopped for a moment, as if gasping for breath.
"Yes," she said. "And you have still preserved this love in your heart. One can only love once. And did you ever see her again?"
"Never."
"Never?"
"I never returned to the country where she lived."
"At Malta?"
"Yes, at Malta."
"She is then now at Malta?"
"I think so."
"And have you forgiven her for all she has made you suffer?"
"Yes, I have pardoned her."
"But only her. Do you then still hate those who separated you?"
"I hate them? Not at all. Why should I?" The Countess placed herself before Monte Cristo, still holding in her hand a portion of the perfumed grapes.
"Take some,"
she said. "Madame, I never eat Muscatel grapes," replied Monte Cristo, as if the subject had not been mentioned before. The Countess dashed the grapes into the nearest thicket with a gesture of despair. "Inflexible man," she murmured. Monte Cristo remained as unmoved as if the reproach had not been addressed to him. Albert, at this moment, ran in. "Oh, mother," he exclaimed, "such a misfortune has happened." "What? What has happened?" asked the Countess, as though awaking from a sleep to the realities of life. "Did you say a misfortune? Indeed, I should expect misfortunes. Monsieur de Villefort is here." "Well?" "He comes to fetch his wife and daughter." "Why so?" "Because Madame de Saint Méran is just arrived in Paris, bringing the news of Monsieur de Saint Méran's death, which took place on the first stage after he left Marseille. Madame de Villefort, who was in very good spirits, would neither believe nor think of the misfortune, but Mademoiselle Valentine, at the first words, guessed the whole truth, notwithstanding all the precautions of her father. The blow struck her like a thunderbolt, and she fell senseless." "And how was Monsieur de Saint Méran related to Mademoiselle de Villefort?" said the Count.
"He was her grandfather on the mother's side. He was coming here to hasten her marriage with France."
"Ah, indeed. France is delayed, then. Why is not Monsieur de Saint Méran also grandfather to Mademoiselle Danglars?"
"Albert, Albert," said Madame de Morcerf in a tone of mild reproof. "What are you saying?" "Ah, Count, he esteemed you so highly. Tell him that he has spoken amiss."
And she took two or three steps forward. Monte Cristo watched her with an air so thoughtful and so full of affectionate admiration that she returned, taking his hand. At the same time, she grasped that of her son and joined them together.
"We are friends, are we not?" she asked.
"Oh, madame, I do not presume to call myself your friend, but at all times I am your most respectful servant." The Countess left with an indescribable pang in her heart, and before she had taken 10 steps, the Count saw her raise her handkerchief to her eyes.
"Do not my mother and you agree?" asked Albert, astonished.
"On the contrary," replied the Count, "did you not hear her declare that we were friends?" They re-entered the drawing-room, which Valentine and Madame de Villefort had just quitted. Monte Cristo departed almost at the same time. 73. Madame de Saint Méran. A gloomy scene had indeed just passed at the house of de Villefort. After the ladies had departed for the ball, whither all the entreaties of Madame de Villefort had failed in persuading him to accompany them, the Procureur du Roi had, as usual, shut himself up in his study with a heap of papers calculated to alarm anyone else, but which generally scarcely satisfied his inordinate desires. But this time the papers were a mere matter of form. Villefort had secluded himself not to study but to reflect. And with the door locked, and orders given that he should not be disturbed, excepting for important business, he sat down in his armchair and began to ponder over those events, the remembrance of which had, during the last 8 days, filled his mind with so many gloomy thoughts and bitter recollections. Then, instead of plunging into the mass of papers piled before him, he opened the drawer of his desk, touched a spring, and drew out a parcel of notes, precious documents, amongst which he had carefully arranged in characters only known to himself the names of all those who, either in his political career, in money matters, at the bar, or in his mysterious love affairs, had become his enemies. Their number was formidable, now that he had begun to fear, and yet these names, powerful though they were, had often caused him to smile with the same kind of satisfaction experienced by a traveller who, from the summit of a mountain, beholds at his feet the craggy eminences, the almost impassable paths, and the fearful chasms through which he has so perilously climbed. When he had run over all these names in his memory, again read and studied them, commenting meanwhile upon his lists,
He shook his head.
No, he murmured. None of my enemies would have waited so patiently and laboriously for so long a space of time that they might now come and crush me with this secret. The story has been told by the Corsican to some priest, who, in his turn, has also repeated it. Monsieur de Monte Cristo may have heard it and to enlighten himself, but why should he wish to enlighten himself upon the subject? Asked Vifor, after a moment's reflection. What interest can he take in discovering a gloomy, mysterious, and useless fact like this? However, amidst all the incoherent details given to me by the Abbé Busoni and by Lord Wilmore, by that friend and that enemy, one thing appears certain and clear in my opinion, that in no period, in no case, in no circumstance, could there have been any contact between him and me. But Vifor uttered words which even he himself did not believe. He dreaded not the revelation so much, for he could reply to or deny its truth, but what he was really anxious for was to discover whose hand had traced them. While he was endeavouring to calm his fears, and instead of dwelling upon the political future that had so often been the subject of his ambitious dreams, he was imagining a future limited to the enjoyments of home, fearing to awaken the enemy that had so long slept. The noise of a carriage sounded in the yard. Then he heard the steps of an aged person ascending the stairs, followed by tears and lamentations such as servants always assume when they wish to appear interested in their master's grief. He drew back the bolt of his door, and almost directly an old lady entered unannounced, carrying her shawl on her arm and her bonnet in her hand. The white hair was thrown back from her yellow forehead, and her eyes, already sunken by the furrows of age, now almost disappeared beneath the eyelids so swollen with grief.
"Oh, sir," she said, "oh, sir, what a misfortune! I shall die of it, oh yes, I shall certainly die of it."
And then, falling upon the chair nearest the door, she burst into a paroxysm of sobs. The servants, standing in the doorway, not daring to approach nearer, were looking at Noirtier's old servant, who, having heard a noise in his master's room, had run there also and remained behind the others. Vifor rose and ran towards his mother-in-law, for it was she.
"Why, what can have happened?" he exclaimed. "What has thus disturbed you? Is Monsieur de Saint Méran with you?" "Monsieur de Saint Méran is dead," answered the old marchioness, without preface and without expression. She appeared to be stupefied. Vifor drew back, and, clasping his hands together, exclaimed, "Dead? So suddenly?" "A week ago," continued Madame de Saint Méran, "we went out together in the carriage after dinner. Monsieur de Saint Méran had been unwell for some days. Still, the idea of seeing our dear Valentine again inspired him with courage, and, notwithstanding his illness, he would leave. When, at 6 leagues from Marseille, after having eaten some of the pastilles he is accustomed to take, he fell into such a deep sleep that it appeared to me to be unnatural. Still, I hesitated to wake him, when I fancied his face became red, and that the veins in his temples throbbed more violently than usual. However, as it became dark and I could no longer see, I fell asleep. I was soon awoke by a piercing shriek, as from a person suffering in his dreams, and he suddenly threw his head back. I stopped the postillion, I called Monsieur de Saint Méran, I applied my smelling salts, but all was over, and I arrived at Aix by the side of a corpse."
Vifor stood with his mouth half open, quite stupefied.
"Of course you sent for a doctor immediately, but, as I have told you, it was too late."
"Yes. But then he could tell of what complaint the poor Marquis had died."
"Oh, yes, sir, he told me. It appears to have been an apoplectic stroke. And what did you do then? Monsieur de Saint-Marin had always expressed a desire, in case of his death happening during his absence from Paris, that his body might be brought to the family vault. I had him put into a leaden coffin, and I am preceding him by a few days. Oh, my poor mother, said de Villefort, to have such duties to perform at your age, after such a blow. God has supported me through all. And then, my dear Marquis, he would certainly have done everything for me that I performed for him. It is true that since I left him, I seem to have lost my senses. I cannot cry. At my age, they say that we have no more tears. Still, I think that when one is in trouble, we should have the power of weeping. Where is Valentine, sir? It is on her account I am here. I wish to see Valentine.
Villefort thought it would be terrible to reply that Valentine was at a ball, so he only said that she had gone out with her stepmother and that she should be fetched.
This instant, sir, this instant, I beseech you, said the old lady.
Villefort placed the arm of Madame de Saint-Marin within his own and conducted her to his apartment.
Rest yourself, mother, he said.
The marchioness raised her head at this word, and beholding the man who so forcibly reminded her of her deeply regretted child, who still lived for her in Valentine, she felt touched at the name of mother, and bursting into tears, she fell on her knees before an armchair, where she buried her venerable head. Villefort left her to the care of the women, while old Barrois ran half-scared to his master, for nothing frightens old men so much as when death relaxes its vigilance over them for a moment in order to strike some other old man. Then, while Madame de Saint-Marin, still on her knees, remained praying fervently, Villefort sent for a hackney coach and went himself to fetch his wife and daughter from Madame de Morcerf's. He was so pale when he appeared at the door of the ballroom that Valentine ran to him, saying,
"Oh, father, some misfortune has happened."
"Your grandmamma has just arrived, Valentine," said Monsieur de Villefort.
"And grandpapa?"
inquired the young girl, trembling with apprehension. Monsieur de Villefort only replied by offering his arm to his daughter. It was just in time, for Valentine's head swam and she staggered. Madame de Villefort instantly hastened to her assistance and aided her husband in dragging her to the carriage, saying,
"What a singular event! Who could have thought it? Ah, yes, it is indeed strange."
And the wretched family departed, leaving a cloud of sadness hanging over the rest of the evening. At the foot of the stairs, Valentine found Barrois awaiting her.
"Monsieur Noirtier wishes to see you tonight," he said in an undertone.
"Tell him I will come when I leave my dear grandmamma," she replied, feeling with true delicacy that the person to whom she could be of the most service just then was Madame de Saint-Marin.
Valentine found her grandmother in bed. Silent caresses, heart-wrung sobs, broken sighs, burning tears were all that passed in this sad interview, while Madame de Villefort, leaning on her husband's arm, maintained all outward forms of respect, at least towards the poor widow. She soon whispered to her husband,
"I think it would be better for me to retire, with your permission, for the sight of me appears still to afflict your mother-in-law."
Madame de Saint-Marin heard her.
"Yes, yes," she said softly to Valentine. "Let her leave, but do you stay."
Madame de Villefort left, and Valentine remained alone beside the bed, for the procureur du roi, overcome with astonishment at the unexpected death, had followed his wife. Meanwhile, Barrois had returned for the first time to old Noirtier, who, having heard the noise in the house, had, as we have said, sent his old servant to inquire the cause. On his return, his quick and intelligent eye interrogated the messenger.
"Alas, sir," exclaimed Barrois, "a great misfortune has happened. Madame de Saint-Marin has arrived,
and her husband is dead. Monsieur de Saint-Marin and Noirtier had never been on strict terms of friendship. Still, the death of one old man always considerably affects another. Noirtier let his head fall upon his chest, apparently overwhelmed and thoughtful. Then he closed one eye in token of inquiry.
"Mademoiselle Valentine?"
Noirtier nodded his head. "She is at the ball, as you know, since she came to say goodbye to you in full dress." Noirtier again closed the left eye.
"Do you wish to see her?"
Noirtier again made an affirmative sign.
"Well, they have gone to fetch her, no doubt from Madame de Morcerf's. I will await her return and beg her to come up here. Is that what you wish for?"
"Yes," replied the invalid. Barrois, therefore, as we have seen, waited for Valentine and informed her of her grandfather's wish. Consequently, Valentine came up to Noirtier on leaving Madame de Saint-Marin, who, in the midst of her grief, had at last yielded to fatigue and fallen into a feverish sleep. Within reach of her hand, they placed a small table, upon which stood a bottle of orangeade, her usual beverage, and a glass. Then, as we have said, the young girl left the bedside to see Monsieur Noirtier. Valentine kissed the old man, who looked at her with such tenderness that her eyes again filled with tears, whose sources he thought must be exhausted. The old gentleman continued to dwell upon her with the same expression.
"Yes, yes," said Valentine. "You mean that I have yet a kind grandfather left, do you not?"
The old man intimated that such was his meaning.
"Alas, happily I have," replied Valentine. "Without that, what would become of me?"
It was 1 o'clock in the morning. Barrois, who wished to go to bed himself, observed that after such sad events everyone stood in need of rest. Noirtier would not say that the only rest he needed was to see his child, but wished her good night, for grief and fatigue had made her appear quite ill. The next morning she found her grandmother in bed. The fever had not abated. On the contrary, her eyes glistened and she appeared to be suffering from violent nervous irritability.
"Oh, dear grandmama, are you worse?" exclaimed Valentine, perceiving all these signs of agitation.
"No, my child, no," said Madame de Saint-Marin.
"But I was impatiently waiting your arrival that I might send for your father."
"My father?" inquired Valentine uneasily.
"Yes, I wish to speak to him."
Valentine durst not oppose her grandmother's wish, the cause of which she knew not, and an instant afterwards Villefort entered.
"Sir,"
said Madame de Saint-Marin, without using any circumlocution, and as if fearing she had no time to lose,
"you wrote to me concerning the marriage of this child."
"Yes, madame," replied Villefort. "It is not only projected, but arranged."
"Your intended son-in-law is named Monsieur France d'Epernay?"
"Yes, madame."
"Is he not the son of General d'Epernay, who was on our side, and who was assassinated some days before the usurper returned from the Isle of Elba?"
"The same."
"Does he not dislike the idea of marrying the granddaughter of a Jacobin?"
"Our civil dissensions are now happily extinguished, mother," said Villefort. "Monsieur d'Epernay was quite a child when his father died. He knows very little of Monsieur Noirtier, and will meet him, if not with pleasure, at least with indifference."
"Is it a suitable match? He is one of the most distinguished young men I know."
During the whole of this conversation, Valentine had remained silent.
"Well, sir," said Madame de Saint-Marin, after a few minutes' reflection, "I must hasten the marriage, for I have but a short time to live."
"You, madame?"
"You, dear mamma?"
exclaimed Monsieur de Villefort and Valentine at the same time.
"I know what I am seeing," continued the marchioness. "I must hurry you, so that, having no mother, she may at least have a grandmother to bless her marriage. I am all that is left to her, belonging to my poor Renée, whom you have so soon forgotten, sir."
"'Ah, madame,' said Vifor, "'you forget that I was obliged to give a mother to my child. "'A stepmother is never a mother, sir. "'But this is not to the purpose. "'Our business concerns Valentine. "'Let us leave the dead in peace.'
All this was said with such exceeding rapidity that there was something in the conversation that seemed like the commencement of delirium.
"'It shall be as you wish, madame,' said Vifor, "'more especially since your wishes coincide with mine, and as soon as Monsieur d'Epernay arrives in Paris—'
"'My dear grandmother,' interrupted Valentine, "'consider decorum, the recent death. "'You would not have me marry under such sad auspices.'
"'My child,' exclaimed the old lady sharply, "'let us hear none of those conventional objections "'that deter weak minds from forming their fortunes. "'I also was married at the deathbed of my mother, "'and certainly I have not been less happy on that account. "'Still, that idea of death, madame,' said Vifor, "'still? Always. "'I tell you I am going to die, do you understand?' "'Well, before dying I wish to see my son-in-law. "'I wish to tell him to make my child happy. "'I wish to read in his eyes whether he intends to obey me. "'In fact, I will know him. "'I will,' continued the old lady with a fearful expression, "'that I may rise from the depths of my grave to find him "'if he should not fulfil his duty.' "'Madame,' said Vifor, "'you must lay aside these exalted ideas, "'which almost assume the appearance of madness. "'The dead, once buried in their graves, rise no more.'
"'And I tell you, sir, that you are mistaken. "'This night I have had a fearful sleep. "'It seemed as though my soul were already hovering over my body. "'My eyes, which I tried to open, closed against my will.' And what will appear impossible above all to you, sir, I saw with my eyes shut, in the spot where you are now standing, issuing from that corner where there is a door leading into Madame de Vifor's dressing room. I saw, I tell you, silently enter a white figure.
Valentine screamed.
It was the fever that disturbed you, madame, said Vifor. "'Doubt, if you please, but I am sure of what I say. "'I saw a white figure, and as if to prevent my discrediting the testimony of only one of my senses, "'I heard my glass removed, the same which is there now, on the table. "'Oh, dear mother, it was a dream. "'So little was it a dream that I stretched my hand towards the bell.' But when I did so, the shade disappeared. My maid then entered with a light. But she saw no one. Phantoms are visible to those only who ought to see them. It was the soul of my husband. Well, if my husband's soul can come to me, why should not my soul reappear to guard my granddaughter? The tie is even more direct, it seems to me. "'Oh, madame,' said Vifor, deeply affected, in spite of himself, "'do not yield to those gloomy thoughts. "'You will long live with us, happy, loved, and honoured, "'and we will make you forget never,' said the marchioness. "'When does Monsieur d'Epernay return? "'We expect him every moment.' "'It is well. "'As soon as he arrives, inform me.' We must be expeditious. And then I also wish to see a notary, that I may be assured that all our property returns to Valentine.
Ah, grandmamma, murmured Valentine, pressing her lips on the burning brow of her grandmother, do you wish to kill me? Oh, how feverish you are. We must not send for a notary, but for a doctor.
A doctor, said she, shrugging her shoulders. I am not ill. I am thirsty. "'That is all.'
"'What are you drinking, dear grandmamma?'
"'The same as usual, my dear. "'My glass is there on the table. "'Give it me, Valentine.'
"'Valentine poured the orangeade into a glass "'and gave it to her grandmother with a certain degree of dread, "'for it was the same glass, she fancied, "'that had been touched by the spectre.
The Marchioness drained the glass at a single draught, and then turned on her pillow, repeating, "The notary! The notary!"
Monsieur de Villefort left the room, and Valentine seated herself at the bedside of her grandmother. The poor child appeared herself to require the doctor she had recommended to her aged relative. She was thinking